Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lewis Friedland, who is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and an affiliated professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he founded and directs the Center for Communication and Democracy. His books include Public Journalism, Past and Future, and Covering the World, International Television News Services. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lewis Friedland.
Thank you.
And clearly, Donald Trump is driving a wedge through the media in this country, in effect creating an alternative media or alternative facts. And he's attacking the fake news, which is what he calls the rest of the media, except for the ones that Fox and Sinclair and Breitbart, etc., that support him. But he seems to have amplified his attacks just in the last couple of days, perhaps to shift blame for his failure of leadership, or at least moral leadership, in terms of what happened in Charlottesville. He tweeted out yesterday that the press are bad people. He retweeted a picture of an express train with Trump written on it crashing into somebody with a CNN logo on it, on him. And then he's also attacked a CNN reporter yesterday at the press conference, after which he finally grudgingly admitted or tried to do some cleanup on his failure to attack the real cause of the violence in Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, etc. After he'd finished those remarks, Jim Acosta of CNN asked him about the press conference he was supposed to hold, and he got very nasty and said, "You're fake news," and stormed out. So this is a battle. Have you ever seen anything, having covered media in this country for a long time, that we are literally having almost two sort of different universes of reality in America?
I think that's a fair way of posing it, Ian. And no, I definitely have never seen anything like this. I don't think many Americans have. But we would have to go back at least to the 1930s to see a nation where these kinds of divisions existed, and even then, while there was an alternative press on both the left and the right, there wasn't this level of vituperation. Of course, Franklin Roosevelt was attacked by many of the, at that time, right-wing newspapers, and he attacked them back, but that's the only analogy I can think of in this century, the last century.
But as a result of the attacks by Father Coughlin and Colonel McCormick and other media barons, Roosevelt introduced the Fairness Doctrine, which was a very simple and elegant way to tone down extreme speech in the media, meaning that if a media owner wanted to use his media assets as a personal soapbox, he would have to offer equal time to the opposing point of view. And that had the effect of calming things down over the decades until 1987, when Ronald Reagan got rid of the Fairness Doctrine at the urging of Rupert Murdoch and others. And that's been the birth of right-wing media, has it not, from that moment on?
No, absolutely. I think you're completely right that the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine under then FCC Chairman Mark Fowler, who basically famously analogized media to a toaster. Essentially, it was another commodity like any other. But, of course, the Fairness Doctrine was built on the idea that the broadcast airwaves are owned by the public, that they're a public good, and that, as such, they needed to the public needed full and fair access to them. And that was the foundation of the Fairness Doctrine. And it did for a very long time, through the first wave of radio and television, constrain the kind of hyper-partisan, vituperative media that we're now not just seeing today, but swimming within today. And so I think that that was a pivotal point, the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987, and it's not incidental that many of the partisans right now of the media environment that we live in are extremely worried about the return of the Fairness Doctrine. Rush Limbaugh regularly editorializes or actually promotes fear of the return of the Fairness Doctrine, and so did actually FCC Chairman Ajit Pai not too long ago, when he helps suppress a report on the state of communications in the United States. So that is a pivotal point, absolutely.
Well, it's not going to happen under the Fairness Doctrine is not going to be reintroduced under Ajit Pai and with the Republicans
definitely
in control.
Not. So definitely not.
So again,
no, I mean, I think it's a pivotal point for not just for people like Pi, who are really working hand in hand with the National Association of Broadcasters and others towards sweeping deregulation, but it really is the basis of the really transformation of the media landscape. I lived and was worked in news in Milwaukee when I first came to Wisconsin 30 years ago or so, not long after the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine. I saw two powerhouse radio stations essentially transformed into conservative media outlets, and this was in 1987, the two stations that covered the entire state. And today in Wisconsin, as a result, in part, in any given day, there's about 70 hours of conservative talk media in our state, in our relatively small state. Of course, that's broken down by market. That's cumulative. But that means roughly 6 hours a day of conservative talk radio in every city in our state. And that's a direct result of the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine.
There's no question that unleashing right-wing media, and they were ready to hit the ground running when the Fairness Doctrine was repealed, has changed the political debate and given it a tremendous advantage to the conservatives. An example being here in Los Angeles, in Southern California, we have what's called the Inland Empire to the east of Los Angeles. And all of the Inland Empire was represented by Democratic congresspeople. But because a lot of people commute from the Inland Empire into Los Angeles, into other parts of Southern California, many of the residents of the Inland Empire spend hours a day in their cars. And a lot of sociologists have done research to indicate that the amount of time they spend in their car being exposed to Rush Limbaugh and his clones who dominate AM and FM radio, that has turned the Inland Empire from Democratic to Republican districts. So I don't know how scientific those findings are, but it may well be an indicator. Let's talk then about what's happening now with this president, who, by the way, I was very struck by the remarks by David Gergen, who served four United States presidents, and he sort of represents where Republicans used to be sensible. He said that Trump can't heal hate in America because he has so much hate in his heart. And it's so clear that this man couldn't repudiate the hatred we saw in Charlottesville. He had to be forced into doing it. And then he gets mad at the media and signals to the very same people that he's criticized, the alt-right neo-Nazis, and sort of saying, blaming everything on the media. And then he tweets out or retweets this picture of an express train with Trump on the side smashing into CNN person with a CNN logo on them. And then he attacks the CNN guy for asking what happened to the press conference you promised and calls him fake news. And then he retweets an extraordinary thing that he retweeted, which I find absolutely surreal. And that is that he took down, by the way, he took down the tweet of the express train, but he allowed the retweet to remain on the president's feed from a Monday night retweet of an alt-right figure known as Jack Prosbiak, who had complained online that violent crimes in Chicago wasn't getting the same media attention as the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. This same guy that the president of the United States retweeted is one of the people who promoted that conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. These are the kind of people that the president of the United States, I mean, if you retweet somebody, that's an endorsement of their opinion, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is wittingly or unwittingly. Sometimes it's hard to separate those two things out with the president's tweet stream, but definitely it's a reendorsement of the views of those people, and there's a natural affinity between the president and those and the alt-right. I think that's pretty obvious to almost anybody who's paying attention.
Right, but Lou, where you've got, he's on the defensive about being too cozy with the alt-right, and then he retweets a prominent alt-right figure. That's pretty.
I agree. It's in a way, it's it's so remarkable at so many levels. You know, not the moral turpitude involved, most importantly, but also at the level of political misunderstanding or tone deafness. And I think that speaks to the larger issue that you raised a few minutes ago, that there is an alternative right-wing ecosystem in the United States, right-wing media ecosystem. And you know, we might have said conservative only a few years ago, and Fox News certainly has drifted farther and farther and farther to the right over since its founding. It was always, of course, a conservative media outlet, but it's become a true right-wing media outlet. And when it begins to merge with Breitbart and the other aspects of the conservative media ecosystem, including older ones like Drudge, which are still there and still very powerful, you have an entire worldview that's available to millions and millions of people every day, and they can feed each other essentially conspiratorial fantasies. And so that's the environment in which it thrives. I mean, what's unique and new is that we have a president who shares those fantasies and actively feeds those fantasies and uses them to explain or attempt to explain away essentially any facts that he doesn't like. And I think one of the big questions that we're going to be facing is, moving forward, is to what extent is that alternative, not only alternative media system, but alternative worldview, really, how much is that moving outside of this 15 or 20% of Americans who really live there? And to what extent is it, you know, influencing people, the 30-40% of American people who sort of live in the middle? And that's, I think, one of the biggest and most, you know, challenging and frightening questions that we're going to be seeing in the, well, certainly in 2018 coming up.
Well, that's actually the area that I wanted to talk about, because I don't think you can write off Trump, and a lot of liberals think he's going to get impeached, and they kind of invested in that without bothering to come up with an alternative narrative so that they can find candidates to challenge this guy with platforms and programs and ideas, which the Democratic Party are sorely lacking in. So it's a really trap, I think, to imagine that this guy's going to self-destruct or the 25th Amendment's going to be invoked or whatever. I mean, he's completely out to lunch. We know that. And he's reckless and dangerous and totally unqualified. And it's a horrible accident that's befallen this country that this man has been elected. But still, can he pull it off? In other words, with this new right-wing media ecosystem that you referred to, if you got Sinclair, which is they're going to make it more powerful, you got Fox, they're going more and more off the rails and more extreme, you got Breitbart and Drudge and all these people, that crowd combined that are creating this alternative universe, along with voter suppression, along with the massive amount of money from Sheldon Adelson and Robert Mercer, these big billionaire backers of Trump. And then on top of that, if Trump creates a little wag the dog war, maybe goes after Iran, who nobody likes Iran, they hate the mullahs, you know, death to America, that'd be very popular. He even mentioned going to war against Venezuela. So this guy's looking around, right. He's looking around for a war, you know. Do you think those things combined could be enough to keep the Republicans in power in 2018 and have this guy reelected in 2020?
You know, I think that's a big question. I'm of two minds about this, like a lot of people. I have sort of Democratic hopes and also the harder edge scenario. And I can't honestly say that I would put a lot of money on one or the other right now. But to be honest, I think a lot of people in the middle, and I'm seeing this in Wisconsin right now, it's a very good place to live because you get a chance to see how many people in the middle, many people who are conservative, who vote for sometimes, not infrequently now, for conservative Republicans, I think a lot of them are both repulsed in some cases, but certainly put off by the company that Trump is keeping. I don't think this is a country yet where you can keep company with Klan wizards and neo-Nazis and claim America. So, well, I think that the right wing...
Can you redo that again? You dropped out. And claim to represent America is what you wanted to say.
The mainstream of America. I think that most people, including many conservative Republicans, not hardcore, you know, not politicos, but people, you know, farmers out here, people who've, you know, work hard and don't necessarily pay a huge amount of attention to politics day in and day out, they don't really like the president palling around with Nazis. And so I think at some point, and I don't want to overstate this, but I think that at some point you reach the limits of the right-wing ecosystem. It's very powerful for ginning up your own supporters, and it will keep the people who are within it highly charged and highly motivated. But I also think that in many ways, the events of the past few days, not just for people on the left or progressives day one, but I think a lot of the people who either voted for Trump or who didn't vote or who are trying, still forming an opinion, the so-called wait and see crowd, what's he, you know, is he going to fulfill his promises to bring back jobs and so on. I think that people are starting to get fairly weary of the guy. And you know, we won't know. The acid test, the first test is really going to be 2018. But I think that you know, the right-wing ecosystem has its limits. I don't want to underestimate it. It's very powerful. And for those who live within it, it's, you know, it's a poisonous fantasy world. So I, you know, I'm not certainly not dismissing it, but I'm saying that I think some of it's coming to light now to people who really haven't paid that much attention. And I think it's likely to have as many actually more negative effects in the long run than positive ones for Trump.
Well, Louis Friedland, I hope you're right and that the American people, the better angels of our nature, emerge here to overcome this hate and this excuse for hate and these hateful people that Trump has around him in the White House. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Louis Friedland, who's a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication and an affiliated professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he founded and directs the Center for Communication and Democracy. His books include Public Journalism, Past and Future, and Covering the World, International Television News Services. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.